Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
Now, one of the things we've talked about quite frequently on the Midweek Drive Live, certainly over the last week or so, has been the writer's strike in Hollywood. And clearly, when we start talking about that, it's a critical aspect because without the words on the page, there won't be anything on the stage, to paraphrase a well-worn phrase of times past. So the Author of the Week feature that we regularly do is clearly even more important from that point of view, as we celebrate our authors and writers and contributors from that point of view. And we're delighted, especially today, to actually welcome critically acclaimed author and creator of the inspiration behind the TV series Wolfpack, of course, which launched earlier this year on Paramount Plus. It's the fabulous Ido Van Belkom. How are you, Ido?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. Before we begin, I just want to get the pronunciation of my name correct. The first name is pronounced Ado, like potato.
Thank you, Ado. That's perfectly okay. We're never quite sure. I mean, you got ego, you got ego, you got Ado. Well, it's all right. Tomato, tomato. We'll work our way through that.
I used to use the word Laredo. But when I was a kid, they called me Ado Potato in the schoolyard. So now I use it to my advantage.
Well, I think Laredo is a classic Western series that really probably needs an updated version in all sorts of ways. But one of those that, along with Bonanza and the Big Valley and probably the Virginian, kind of, again, very much part of pivotal 1960s television, shall we say.
Yes, absolutely. But I'm always in line for telling jokes. And when I was touring with the Wolfpack series originally, it was in front of a lot of elementary school kids, and telling them that I used to be called Ado Potato always got some giggles. So it, you know, garnered some friends.
Well, and again, they can be tough audiences, certainly from the adolescent routine. So, you know, it's worth noting from that perspective. Okay, let's talk initially about, obviously, Wolfpack, and we want to obviously progress to a whole range of things as the program proceeds. But as I say, I watched this earlier this year on Wolfpack, partly because I must admit I was intrigued by what this latest incarnation of the career of Sarah Michelle Gellar would bring to the world, and actually found myself being gradually drawn into the series. I mean, I was thinking, clearly it starts off, or started off certainly, with the very ecological side of things in terms of forest fires and issues relating to that. But out of that whole thing, as the inspiration behind the series, how much were you happy? Because I'm often struck by authors who, you know, sometimes there's virtually no connection whatsoever between what is actually seen on screen and what was originally written, other than possibly the title. From your own perspective, how much interconnection was there between, obviously, the Wolfpack novel and text, etc., and winner of the Aurora and Silver Birch Awards, and what we actually finally saw?
Well, I never saw the TV series until I went to the premiere in Los Angeles. So I was there watching it for the first time, like everyone else. And I was waiting for a moment where I could look at the screen and say, ah, that's from my book. That's from my book. I wrote that scene. And it never happened. Okay, so in my initial reaction was I was a little disappointed. And I got home that night, and my son, who had advanced copies and watched it previously, but hadn't told us anything about it, explained to me everything Jeff Davis was doing, the setup and everything. And I slowly came around, and I've come to terms with it. I tell people that it's the inspiration for, it's not the guidebook. If you're going to read the four books to find out what happens in season two, that's not going to be there. It's the inspiration. The core situation is there. The forest ranger who adopts werewolf children as werewolf cubs and raises them on his own, that's central. And a lot of things are central to the book and central to the series, but there's not yet really anything lifted out of the book and placed directly on the screen. That could change with season two, because the opening of the story explains how the ranger ended up adopting the werewolf cubs. And in season two, Rodrigo Santoro's character, Ranger Briggs, is going to have a discussion with Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, Kirsten Ramsay, about how they came to be in his care. And when that happens, I know they've already filmed all the scenes and they use them as flashbacks, but hopefully in season two, there will be a scene where all of that is put together. And when that happens, it'll be, that's from my book, you know, the gratification. But I know that historically, lots of things are inspiration for, not guidebooks, particularly the Witcher series. It's been explained to me that how that was changed dramatically, and all kinds of things get changed dramatically. So I've come to terms with it, and I'm happy for it. And, you know, whatever Jeff does, I know it's for the best of the show and ultimately the books and the show together. So I've made peace with it, and I'm just looking forward. Hopefully there's a season two.
Well, indeed. So, I mean, it's interesting, of course, because historically, I'm always minded of a mutual friend of ours, Arthur Weingarten, who sadly passed away. But Arthur was next door neighbors to a certain Harlan Ellison. And Harlan, as you might be aware, would not necessarily make peace in such a sanguine manner as you have actually done. He'd probably actually be reaching for the lawsuit literally as the opening credits were being launched.
Well, he would probably do that, but you have to understand that when you sell the rights and they give you, you know, a little bag of money, it's theirs to do what they want. But you end up mentioning Harlan Ellison. I'm going to give you this little tidbit. There's four werewolf cubs in the book. The names have been changed for the TV series, but in the book, they're Tora, Argus. Now I'm even forgetting. Tora, Argus, Noble, and Harlan. And I named the fourth one Harlan because he was the runt of the litter. And that was my little inside joke to Harlan Ellison. If you've ever met the man, he's diminutive, only in stature, not in breadth of character or stature as a writer or any of those things, but only in his stature as a physical being. So I thought I'm going to pay tribute to him by naming him Harlan, the runt of the litter. Hopefully, if he's looking down, he's got a little kick out of that and forgives me that little indulgence.
I'm sure he will. I'm probably actually chatting with Arthur as well from that point of view. I thought you might have actually named possibly the Cubs Kurt or indeed Ray after Vonnegut and Bradbury, but maybe you thought that was not appropriate from that sort of point of view.
No, I named them according to their character type. Noble is the leader. And Argus is the strongest and the one who's up to a fight. And I named the female Tora also because of a character trait. In the book, they named one of the females Luna, which I guess, you know, the reference to the moon, of course. But in my novels, the moon doesn't play anything to do with their transformation. So I decided to leave that out. But all of the characters were named specifically for their character traits, and the names have something to do with the forest and nature as well.
Now, dialing back slightly in terms of time and so on, you were born obviously in Toronto, Ontario. You graduated from York University with an honours degree in creative writing. But then, from at least our research that we've seen through the joyous World Wide Web, you went into journalism and actually worked as a full-time journalist for 5 years as a sports reporter and then as a police reporter. So, was it what you saw on the sports fields that led you to horror?
Well, no. Let me backtrack. Yes, I was studying creative writing, and then halfway through, I realized, you know, I'm going to have a degree in creative writing, and I'm going to be not unqualified to take on just about any job there is. I mean, I don't see creative writing degrees as resume as requirements for many jobs. So I thought I better learn a trade. So halfway through, I went to the school newspaper and started doing reporting. Even though the school didn't have a journalism program, I thought I better learn something. And so when I get out of here, I'll have a trade to ply. And I became the sports editor. Sports was fun. And I mean, if you're going to go and cover something. They call sports departments in newspapers the toy department, and it was fun to go to events and things like that. So I learned that, and I was doing the degree and doing the newspaper. It was a weekly newspaper at the same time. And when I finished, I got a job as a newspaper reporter. Now, the important thing about that is I worked on small newspapers, and you're probably aware of the theory about the 10,000 hours, having to spend 10,000 hours doing something. And when you're working for a small town newspaper, you are writing constantly, and it appears in the paper the very next day, whether it's good or bad, and you must produce. And that's where I did my 10,000 hours of writing. Writing stories constantly, day after day, you know, 2-3 stories a day. And when I finished, I started writing. As a matter of fact, I wrote my first story at the newspaper on one of those clunky keyboards that had a little dial underneath you could turn up and it would make the sound of a typewriter. That's the transition I was at, typewriter to computer. And I wrote a story called Baseball Memories, which had to do with baseball statistics. And it was both a horror and a science fiction story. And it ended up being reprinted in Year's Best Horror Stories 20. So from sports journalist to sports fiction writer to horror writer, it all was a smooth transition. And it was really beyond my control. I just wrote the story that I wanted to write. And publication history, you know, took care of where it ended up. And from there, I decided, yeah, I like doing present day stuff with a hint of supernatural. That's why in the Wolfpack series, these are four teenage werewolves who have all the problems of teenagers, puberty, bullies, you know, high school pressures, girlfriends, you know, all of that, plus they're werewolves. So that was always my intention, set in the present day with a hint of a supernatural element.
One of the things I recall the Joss Whedon team behind Buffy the Vampire Slayer being regularly asked was basically, how do they manage to capture teenage vernacular? How do they effectively manage to capture the speech and the patterns of teenagers and so on? And I think the official answer was they were just being creative and these things happened to sort of work through the process. Did you actually do any research in terms of high school environments and so on? Or did you sort of think, well, yeah, this will probably work?
Well, I like to think that, you know, it's almost cliche, like the mom on the block who thinks she's the cool mom because she's in touch with all the kids. I like to think that that was me, the cool guy who still had a finger in pop culture and knew something about the way kids talk. But there might have been some of that. But, you know, I wrote the stories that I wanted to, the stories that I thought were the right thing, the kind of problems. And I also spent 3 years as a writer. You don't make a living just solely as writing. You always have to have some kind of part-time job. One of my part-time jobs was school bus driver. So I spent a lot of time with kids on the school bus and learned how vicious they can be towards each other, how self-centered, how immature and, you know, nasty. And I put that all in the books and some short stories that I wrote also. But so it was, I was writing from the, you know, my throne, but I was still in the trenches with the kids and had an idea how they acted and how they dealt with one another. So I was quite proud of that. I think it came through in the books.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think the developing ego is something which it's not just Freud who wrote extensively on it, but it's something which echoes through everything from Shakespeare onwards, really. Let's talk a little bit about what we started this little piece off, which is, of course, what's going on industrially with respect to the Hollywood scenario and so on. And two things which really coalescing together, arguably some might say, put forward in the current Mission Impossible movie, where the villain is artificial intelligence and so on, or the master computer, the AI format that's actually there. First of all, in terms of writers, do you feel as though, to a large extent, writers tragically have always received the pointy end of the stick or the brown end of the stick? And in essence, unless you kind of reach, shall we say, J.K. Rowling levels, it's rare that actually you get the acknowledgement for the kind of, you know, essential originality and creativity that you bring to the party, without which, as we said, nothing would actually happen.
Yes, I would agree with that. Writers are the creative engine in just about everything, Hollywood, advertising. And it's funny, as the author of the book that the series is based on, I always feel that nobody cares. Nobody cares that I wrote the book. Nobody cares that it's based on a book. I'll give you an example. There was lots of social media pages to do with Wolfpack, and one was from Italy. And I thought, oh, great, I'm half Italian, I can understand the language a little bit. And when the book was first published, there was an edition in Italy published as well. It's called Lupi Selvaggi. So I wrote to this girl and I said, oh, that's great. You know, the book was actually published in Italy. Here's a cover, maybe you can use it on your page. And she said, thanks, but I don't think I'll be using this. This page is all about the TV show. I'm like, oh my God, like, what do I have to do to draw myself in with the TV show? It's not enough that I wrote the book that it's based on. You know, and I was at the LA premiere, and I got out of the limousine, and everyone was looking, and the disappointment I could see on their face, like, who's this guy? They were waiting for some superstar to come out of the limousine, and it was just me, and people were saying, okay, move along. I said, no, I'm going to walk down the red carpet. I'm the guy who wrote the book. And then they asked my name and they looked on their little computer. Oh, your name is here. Oh, go ahead, sir. You know, like, and it was just, there was a lot of like that. And it's kind of funny. You know, the guy who is not like that, though, is the creator of the show, Jeff Davis. Props to him for giving credit where credit's due. And I thanked him. I said, you know, thank you for putting the credit based on a novel by Ado van Velkom in the opening credits. Because although it's contractually obligated by them, usually they put it at the start of the end credits where no one is paying attention. But he said, no, it's going to be there every episode. And I just was, you know, so thankful to him because he didn't have to do that. And he's changed it enough that no one would ever. You know, why did you do that? Because it's based on this book. He did that all on his own, and I give him credit for that. But generally speaking, it's a hard row to hoe because people really are unconcerned with that. Hopefully, it'll change as the series progresses, season two,
I
maybe
mean,
season three.
if I
But
can
right
draw,
now, I can't help but feel that way.
I mean, if I can draw a parallel, it was many years, and it actually took an awful lot of activism from the likes of Neil Adams in particular, before comic book artists were actually really acknowledged as being worthwhile, and arguably even the banner rule of Stan Lee to actually put Jack Kirby, Stan Lee, Steve Ditko, others, Steve Englehart, and so on, up to the present day. You know, up until then, effectively, the writers who were creating these highly popular characters, both DC, Marvel, and others, effectively were almost anonymous. And that kind of importance, again, constantly needs to be flagged. It's the whole essence why we have Author of the Week. We want to kind of start digging into the creative process and celebrating that.
Well, Stan Lee's a whole nother issue. There's, you know, documentaries on his contribution to the comics world, and then people come out of the woodwork and say, "Oh, it wasn't quite that way. I remember it differently." But you are correct that a lot of times the germ of it is lost, and the people who are getting credit are, you know, people who've taken that, expanded on it, changed it slightly. But I have no problem with the way things have gone. As I said, the credit's there, the opening credit and in the opening credits of the show. And I must say, I'm having a blast. The last 18 months were the most fun I've ever had as a writer, and I hope to continue. If there's a season two, I suspect it'll be another year and more. And if there's a season two, Jeff has said he's adamant that I do a cameo. So then I'll be that next level. I'll be one of those guys that was in the show, and maybe people will pay attention then because I died on the show or something, or the camera panned by me. Not
You
only
might be
the
the school
writer,
bus
but he's,
driver, Ado. You could be the school bus driver.
you know, there was one in
Yeah,
the
I know,
opening
yeah.
scene, and she got smoked. And I was thinking I would love to for that to happen because then I'd have to go back 2 days. I'd go one day to get killed and then the next day to come back with all of the makeup on. And that would be a thrill, but who knows what happens. Jeff has said that, and it'll be fun if it happens, but let's just hope there's a season two.
Well, as I say, the campaign obviously continues, and fingers crossed with respect to that. Let's move on slightly to again that other aspect, which I think one of our regular director correspondents, Phil Leonis, has said, yeah, that's typical big budget Hollywood. They actually go for the lowest but most important part of the ladder and refuse to pay them rights and so on. And again, we're talking about writers and issues relating to that. Of course, the specter of ChatGPT is ever emerging. It's becoming not just in higher education, but in all aspects, fake news, in other social media, something which is actually there, and the sophistication of programs are developing on that basis. Is that something which you would embrace, which you'd say, great, I'll just share my thoughts with my faithful artificial intelligence friend, and they could write the whole text? Or is it something where you think, I don't know, this is just doesn't quite feel right?
I am absolutely against the use of artificial intelligence in anything to do with the writing profession. First of all, you have to understand that all of these programs assimilate and take in everything that's been done before and then regurgitate something that's a little bit of everything. If you're looking for a brand new idea, it's not going to come from AI. At least I don't think so, based on what I've seen. If you're not going to get the idea of a forest ranger fighting a fire and then finding werewolf cubs hidden in a safe spot after the fire and then taking them on as his own, you're not going to get that. You're going to get some rehash of all the werewolf tropes that have all gone before, mixed together. Maybe they be mixed together in some new way, but there's no way that there's going to be an original spark. And AI is going to go for a little while. People are going to think this is great, but when all if there's productions based on AI and people realize they're bereft of any new ideas, then it's going to slowly implode on itself and it'll vanish. But I'd like to see that happen before. I've seen people do songs and like a Johnny Cash song based, it was one recently I saw. And all of the words were good and they fit in right and everything. But that's taking someone else's song, giving an idea from somewhere else, putting it together. And, where's the original idea coming from? It's not going to come from AI.
We cited Ray Bradbury earlier in the piece, and obviously Kurt Vonnegut Jr., both of whom very significant players, although Bradbury known for his, I think, lyricism, his poeticism, and of course his resonance, even across the decades with everything from Dandelion Wine, Martian Chronicles. I mean, we could go on. There are so many, Something Wicked This Way Comes, and so on. Kurt Vonnegut Jr., probably from my own perspective, best known for Slaughterhouse-Five, which was an interesting tale of the Tralfamagorians and other sort of aspects within that. Are there any other authors who you found particularly influential in your own kind of development as a horror and fantasy fan, really, from that point of view?
Yes, Ray Bradbury. I've said this many times. The writer who got me into writing, The October Country, my favorite book of all time. I read that book and thought, wow, every story in there was fantastic. That's the kind of writer I wanted to be. I wanted to write stories that people would read and say, wow, that was terrific. So that's what I set out to do. Others along those lines, Robert Bloch, author of Psycho, of course, everyone knows that.
And
But a
Catspaw, and of course, Wolf in the Fold, two classic episodes of the
yes.
original Star Trek series.
He had a great career as a television writer in Hollywood for a long time. And I met him at a science fiction convention in London. And he said, even at that time, and that was in the 90s, he said the same situation couldn't happen again because at that time they were just, taking scripts from writers independently. And now you've got, and this is even 30 years on, writers' rooms and, showrunners and things like that. So he said it could never happen again. But Robert Bloch wrote all kinds of stories that I love that took present day and put a little fantasy to them and a little sarcastic wit or a little surprise ending, a little twist at the end. And as I read just about everything I could of him, that's I decided I wanted to do that too. My favorite story of his is Enoch, where this serial killer has this demon on his shoulder. No one can see it. And he's dealing with the, I think it's the district attorney or some kind of lawyer. And the lawyer says, sort of flippantly, oh, well, why don't you let me take him? I'll take him off you. And he said, oh, will you do that, please? Turns out that the demon is real. And now this guy who just said, oh, yeah, I'll take him and didn't believe a word that the prisoner was saying now is damned to have this demon on his shoulder whispering incredibly crazy things in his ear for the rest of his life. But fantastic. I love that. It's exactly the kind of thing that I want to do. So he was one. American writer Joe R. Lansdale, love his writing. Some of the series and the short stories that he did were fantastic. Ed Gorman, which is like a workmanlike writer, done a lot of different genres and everything, but I admire him very much because every time out, it's a good, well-written story, novels, well-paced, well-plotted, everything like that. And that's what I appreciate, people who write stories with beginnings, middles, and ends, and somehow along the way give me the surprise that I think, oh, I didn't see that. That's fantastic. And each of those writers, when I was writing, I say, I'm going to try and write a story like this, but with something else. And they say great songwriters borrow from others. No, good songwriters borrow from others. Great songwriters steal. And that's the same case in writing short stories. The good ones borrow. Great ones steal. And I've stolen a couple of ideas from others, but made them my own, of course. Something that AI couldn't do. They could borrow it and make it something similar, but not make it their own, because there is no their own. They're artificial intelligence.
There's an apocryphal tale I think I once heard, and you might be able to confirm this or deny it. According to Robert Bloch, it was once said he had the heart of a child. He kept it in a bedside jar by his table, basically, on his table.
That is true. It actually was at a science fiction convention, and he was giving the guest of honor speech. And while he was doing, he says, "Some people say I might have the heart of a child." And he produced the jar in the speech, and it's true. I have it right here. And everyone fell out of their chair laughing. And that was the kind of writer he was. He could take the macabre and give it this twist and make it hilarious at the same time. And I've often made the case that humor and horror are both sides of the same thing. They both elicit a reaction from the reader. It's a thin line from laughing to crying, yeah, one of my favorites, Robert Bloch.
I'm pleased you confirmed my belief, because sometimes with the passing of years, I thought, was that actually true? I suppose I could have actually used a line from
No,
that.
you're
It's
right on. It
interesting.
was true. Just the context was a little different.
Yeah.
But I'm
It's
sure he
it.
used that joke again and again and again in speeches and in essays and things like that. It's too good not to. Why couldn't you?
Absolutely. And again, interesting in terms of the a relationship between comedy and horror. One of the seminars I run at the University of Lincoln is actually based exactly on that factor, that actually they're building up to the tension and the gag line in comedy, or the pratfall, or the situation is very similar to the kind of shock that you'd immerse yourself in with respect to often the cathartic release of a horror movie or a novel or areas within that. Let's talk music. Some writers prefer to have a wonderful soundtrack when they're actually perform when they're at the keyboard, when they're creating material, etc. Some people prefer absolute silence. Some prefer music without lyrics. Some prefer whatever. Do you have a particular soundtrack that you'd like to set up before you set up on the next series of adventures within Wolfpack and more?
To your question, when I was writing and when I'm writing, I have nothing going on in the background, no music, no anything. Totally focused. I found in my life that if I have distractions while I'm writing, it doesn't come out as good. And the best writing is when not only at the moment, but in my entire life focused on writing. The only thing I have going is the writing, and that's when I'm laser focused. So yeah, I know I've seen videos of Stephen King with, rock music blaring in the background and him going away. But no, I need silence and focus, and it's all about me and the page, and that's it. But everyone has their own style. That's the one that suits me.
Absolutely. Well, Noble, Argus, Harlan, and Tora, of course, normally like any other teenagers, but as we've been discussing and weaving in and out of this discussion, they're obviously part of that wolf pack scenario. The fourth in the series is obviously around. You can also go for Lone Wolf, Cry Wolf, and of course, Wolf Man. If I was pushed, and not that I'm sort of saying I would be, but I would probably say that my favorite incarnation from the Universal Monsters series was indeed Lon Chaney Jr. as Wolf Man. Now, that was obviously back in the days of makeup and all sorts of things, etc. I always felt in many ways, there were elements of that not only had Jekyll and Hyde overtones and subsequently led to Bruce Banner and Incredible Hulk overtones, but it was a kind of tragic, heroic character that we saw there. Then, of course, the werewolf really kind of got an upgrade with respect to the workings of American Werewolf in London. Probably the same thing with The Howling, a similar sort of 1980s line where it sort of started getting embedded in terms of the technique, etc. Which incarnation, apart from obviously Wolfpack, which inevitably I'd say, but they're my children. Wolfpack obviously would be my favorite werewolves. Which ones from kind of cinematic or indeed literary history would you say that would be my favorite werewolf?
Well, I'm aware of The Howling, and I did meet Gary Brandner back in the day and formed a little relationship with him. I'd found a couple of obscure novels that he written, and I sent him copies, and he sent me a copy of The Howling, and I said, "You got to send from my to my great friend Ado Van Velkom, that was great. The Howling, yes, American Werewolf in London, great, because I love the part where they said, they get warned, stay on the path, don't venture from the path. And there's that moment where don't venture from the path. And they look around and say, oops, we've ventured from the path, which it goes right to all of those horror movies where the character comes out and says, don't do this. If you do that, bad things will happen. And they have to do that because bad things need to happen, but they acknowledge it so they can kind of get away with it. So I love that. And I love the gritty realism and The Howling. I love the sexual aspect of it. Of course, I can't put that in the Wolfpack series, but I did put it in my first ever novel, Wormwolf, which was a game tie-in, and I had like just three-page sex scene in there because I thought, what the hell? My book, I'm going to put it in there with some great werewolf sex, and I did manage to get it in there. But there's a film, a Canadian film, that you didn't mention called Ginger Snaps, in
Course,
which these
yes.
teenage girls get afflicted. And I loved how it was set in reality. And when they did the change, it was incorporated into the real world, and they had to deal with this thing. And there were girls going through puberty and everything, and the whole thing. So that was one of my favorites, that you can make a film respecting the werewolf genre, not just, crazy, let's fangs and teeth and hair and anger. Let's make it in a different way. It can be subtle and still on point and still tied to reality. So that's one of the ones. But when you're writing a book like this, you take everything and you decide what's best for it. For example, my werewolves, they don't need the moon. And the book opens with them trying. They're shape-shifting and practicing it because it's a talent they need to master before they can move on. So a lot of little things from everywhere, but Ginger Snaps is certainly one of my favorite werewolf depictions on screen.
Of course, we go all the way back to good quality writing. It was indeed Coetzee Odmak who coined that phrase, "Even a man who is pure of heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn moon is bright." Many people thought, I think at the time, that it was an ancient prophecy. It was actually just written for the Universal movie at the time. So again, the power of the writer.
Writer's rule.
Ado, it's been awesome sharing some thoughts with your good self today. How can people actually follow you? Do you have a Facebook page? Is there a Meta? Are you TikToking like crazy? Or is it just a case of just keep reading those books?
No, I wrote an article recently called "Writing is Easy, Social Media is Hard," because today happens to be my 61st birthday, by the way. So I'm coming to social media way late. I have a Facebook page, which is like your grandfather's social media, but I'm on there and I post regularly. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, and a little bit on TikTok. And I also have a YouTube channel, which has all kinds of stuff related to the Wolfpack series and the books, and also a bunch of things I did previously, like hosting horror movies on Scream TV and Halloween shorts for Saturday morning cartoons on Fox 29, all kinds of things there. So YouTube, just put my name in, all of them. Just type in my name. If you can't find me, you're not looking hard enough.
Exactly,
And
exactly.
I'm learning this social media. I don't know how you get thousands of views. I'm still stuck on hundreds, but I'm learning and
We just need to borrow some of the Lady Gaga stuff, perhaps. But that's another line for another time. Ada, we've got two final questions for you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Oh yeah, you're asking a lot of questions people don't usually ask, and you've got a background, or you've done research, either one, that in horror and fiction, and you're bringing it all together. So I'm just thrilled because I've done a lot of podcasts in the last year and a half. Some of them I'm just wondering, why am I here? But not this one. This one was great, and I appreciate it. I had a lot of fun too.
Well, then the next critical question is, can we prevail upon you to join us again sometime? Will you come along and share more of the magic of your writing and universe with us?
Anytime you want me to, I'll be there. Hopefully, we'll go into season two and there'll be a whole nother thing to talk about. And I'll hopefully have a cameo and that'll be interesting too. So, yeah, anytime you want me on, this was great. I'll do it again in a heartbeat.
What do we mean by the term inflation? Well, don't worry if you don't actually know what the term inflation actually means, because you will not be alone within that. Despite the fact that we've been covering this quite extensively and people talk about, oh, lower inflation, higher inflation, shrinkflation, and so on and so forth, recent research suggests that a third of British folk don't understand the term inflation. So to talk us through this and maybe actually provide some useful tips for financial literacy, we're delighted to welcome the Relationship Banking Director from Lloyds Bank, Jo Harris. How are you, Jo?
I'm very good, thank you. Good to be talking to you today, Alex.
Well, likewise. But really surprising that, as I say, nearly half of British people are scared away from investing their money because they're bamboozled by the complicated jargon. I didn't think inflation was that difficult a question to deal with, but one in 20 apparently have never even heard of inflation.
Yeah, I mean, we are hearing inflation talked about in almost every news bulletin at the moment, but it's fascinating seeing this research and understanding that some of these terms, people really do feel quite daunted by the jargon. And I mean, if you take inflation and just at a really simple level, all it means is what you might put in your shopping basket today for £10 of spend, in 3, 4, 5 years, for your £10, you're going to have less things in your basket. And it's really important to understand this, because as we think about our money and our savings, over time, inflation can mean that our savings are worth less to us tomorrow than they were today. So actually, it's been really interesting seeing the research, finding that we've got, you know, over half of Brits are interested in thinking about the longer term and investing, but are just put off because of some of this jargon that flies around the place.
I mean, I can understand to a certain extent why the most misunderstood investment term is asset class. Over three quarters of us actually were confused about asset class and so on. But is this a case of actually the problem starts a lot earlier? We need to actually start developing some financial literacy in our educational institutions, because otherwise, how can one expect adults to actually understand what it's all about?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's so important, along with overall education, just to start our children and young people understanding finances from an early age. And there's some great things to do. It might sound old fashioned, but, you know, just children having pocket money and getting that understanding of what it means to save. They've seen something that they really want to buy, taking the time to build up their savings and being able to buy that. Even things like that are really important, as well as, you know, having these conversations in school, because really good financial knowledge that, you know, in later life helps you understand what have I got coming in each month, what have I got going out each month, and then, you know, what can I afford to save and think about for the future. All of those are great habits that we can start to build really from a really young age.
And again, terms such as portfolio, stocks and shares, dividends and so on are all possibly mystical concepts to many people and so on. Do you feel that actually people need to, in a sense, look to take control over their finances and actually look to demystify these words, which is one of the reasons you've got together with Susie Dent to actually produce this guide to investment terminology?
Yeah, that's right. So we've been working with Susie because she's been fabulous at helping us understand the origins of some of these terms. And one of my favourites that I've learnt working with her is the term gilts, which 70% of us don't understand. But gilts simply refer to the loans that are taken out by the government when it wants to raise money. But actually, that term has come about because originally these were paper certificates that were issued and they had a gilt edge. So there's some lovely history behind some of these terms. But what I would say is you really don't need to understand all of this and, you know, the asset classes and growth funds and equities and all those sorts of things that put people off and we know are intimidating 50% of Brits. What we've been doing at Lloyds Bank, and many others are doing something similar, is saying, look, we've got some ready-made investments where all you need to do is decide what level of risk you're happy to take with your money, because these do come with a degree of risk. But beyond that, the experts will then put together the investment for you, and they will manage all of that. And we think this is really important because we know that over half of Brits are interested in investing and they see the benefit of it, but they're put off. So we're really hoping that the ready-made investments are a great first step in. If either you haven't got time to research, you're not sure how to get started, or you have just been put off by some of these terms we've been talking about.
Although I suppose the caveat is, as ever, stocks can go up as well as down in terms of the way forward. But
they absolutely can, and it's I would just say actually, Alex, it won't be right for everybody. You know, so some people at the moment will be just, you know, trying to get through the month and making ends meet. And in those situations, I would say, you know, always talk to your bank or your building society because they are there to help you. And even if you have got some money and you can think about saving, it's always really good to have a bit of a rainy day fund that you can access, that, you know, we all have those unexpected things that pop up and the bills that we need to pay. So it's always a good idea to build up that sort of savings pot first before you think about whether investing is right for you.
Absolutely. Well, we won't go into further details such as bear markets and such like, but I have to say, Joe, I've never quite understood why the sign of a black horse is actually connected with banking, but never mind. That's another line entirely for another discussion, perhaps. Finally, Joe, where would you recommend people should actually go to find out further details about what we've been discussing today?
So if you search for Lloyds Bank ready-made investments or visit lloydsbank.com/RMI, that'll get you started.
Joe Harris, Relationship Banking Director from Lloyds Bank. Many thanks indeed and happy investing, Joe.
Thank you very much.
So how many times can you have a round of Old MacDonald's had a farm, or indeed the wheels of the bus go round and round? Well, yeah, certainly if you're in the car and you have the toddler in the back seat, obviously safely strapped down, etc., you may well be challenged in terms of how do you keep them entertained? How do you actually work through that process? I mean, apart from the fact that obviously you wish they could just go to sleep. But that's by the by. We're delighted to welcome back to the program, of course, ace child psychologist extraordinaire, Dr. Sam Waz, to talk about this. How are you, Sam?
Hi, very well. Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always great to connect with your good self. And surprised by some of these findings, though. 57%, that's over half of parents, still favour the long-distance car for travelling with children. So that's fine. But a whopping 41% find it difficult to keep their children entertained during a long car journey. Is this because iSpy is not as popular as it used to be?
Well, I mean, that's a good way of doing it. I actually read it differently. I was like, what about the 59%? Because I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old in my family. And, you know, we've definitely experienced this a lot, that, you know, these car journeys, they just feel endless. And you're looking at the sat nav and there's an hour and 40 minutes to go. And oh my goodness me, what are we going to do for the next hour and 40 minutes? So yeah, the research does show, you know, as we're expecting, that a lot of parents do find them challenging. I think one of the reasons, Alex, is, it varies a lot depending on the age of your children. So mine are preschoolers, and that was very much the age that we were targeting with this age range. And a lot of games like I Spy, they just can't play at this age. You have that really unfair thing that they can't, not only do they find it hard to follow a story, and that's something I want to come back to, you know, why children find it hard to follow stories, and something that we can do to help, because that's definitely a great way to pass the time in a car journey. But you have young children who find it hard to follow a story anyway. And the added irony, and I always think this is so unfair, is they're too small to see out of the window. So they can look up, so they can see a little slither of sky. But me and my wife are always frantically pointing out cars and sheep out the window when they just can't see them because they're at the wrong angle. So I think that's really, really unfair that children can't even stare blankly out the window when they're young.
Yeah, being bored, being unsettled, and of course, the ultimate having a toilet accident, all very much in terms of challenges that we're faced with. But is it a case of you need to have a sing song, that actually those songs and verbal games are very much the best way of actually keeping young minds occupied and not fretting on the fact that they can't see anything that they're supposed to be seeing, and it's almost as though they're in a sensory deprivation tank?
Yeah, definitely, Alex. So singing is one of the things. So with this campaign, we're really, really keen to raise awareness about singing. particularly with a young kid, so with the pre-verbal kids, where, as I say, stories, which I want to talk about in a second as well, but with the really young kids, the pre-verbal kids, stories aren't often, they're just not ready for them yet. But even young kids, even my two-year-old, who's only got a few words, who loves a sing-along. And from my point of view as a researcher, Alex, there's a lot of reasons why that's a really, really good thing to be doing with the kids. So a couple of reasons. So firstly, it's when you're singing, you have to breathe as if you're calm. So normally when we're feeling tense or anxious, or, you know, everyone's kicking off, we tend to breathe fast and shallowly. But then when we're calm, we take these long, deep, slow breaths in and out. And when we're singing, that's the way that we breathe too. We take a deep breath and we let it out slowly. And the research suggests that just forcing ourselves to breathe as if we're calm can actually help us to stay calm. So it's that old rule, fake it till you make it. And that's actually very evidence-based now as a way of managing emotions. So that's one of the reasons why, if you've got kids who are kicking off in the car, putting on a song to sing along to can help. And the other thing, which is, again, there's really quite a strong evidence base for this now, Alex, from the research literature, that doing things together, whether it's a game of ice by or singing a song together, you're doing actions at the same time. So you're all breathing in at the same time, and you're saying the same words at the same time. And the research suggests that doing things together with people at the same time helps to promote a feeling of togetherness. And it helps to promote kind of mutual understanding. It's the same reason why we like to go to sports matches and we like to go to the theatre and do stuff together, why people like singing in choirs, that type of thing. This coordinated actions, you know, make us feel together as a group. So if you've got some siblings who are rowing, or if you're rowing with your own kids, then literally putting on a song will put everyone in a good mood, but it also helps to see things from other people's point of view, to think, you know, we're all in this together.
Obviously, when you are in a car, if you happen to be the designated driver, you want to keep your focus very much on the road and not necessarily on the, oh, I'm sorry I had that accident. I was just actually too engaged with a sing song with my children. That's not going to cut any mustard whatsoever. So I was pleased to see that you do recommend things like in-car entertainment, but audio can be a good way of actually ensuring that people can, or children can be kept entertained by listening to stories, etc. Presumably car radios as well can also help in terms of music?
Car radios and listening to music can definitely help, yeah. But definitely one of the things that I think, if you can get it working, will keep you going for much longer than songs, is listening to stories. And this was something I really wanted to emphasize, because, you know, for this campaign with Bing, we're really, really trying to emphasize stories. So there are a lovely selection of audio stories on the Bing app, or, you know, other ways of getting them too. But the really key thing, Alex, that I wanted to talk about is, you know, for young children, so we're thinking about preschoolers here, they often find it hard to follow a story. But what you shouldn't do is just give up and say, okay, they're not ready for stories yet. So car journeys can be a great opportunity to practice, to help children to learn to practice understanding a story and following a story. So you've got a story that you're listening to, and rather than just, you know, our adult brains are so good at making sense of a story that we assume that kids can just do the same thing. So we just listen to one story once, then we go straight on to the next one. But in fact, all the research suggests that children's brains find it hard to make sense of a story, and it helps to do things like pause it when it's going. So, you know, you started a bit of the story, then you pause it, you explain what's just happened again. If there are any hard words in there, you explain what those words mean to help them to follow what's happening in the story. And then at the end of the story, you repeat it, you tell the story again, you express it in different words, you get them to talk about it, you get them to ask questions, and then you actually go back and listen to the same story again. And as I say, this is because the research suggests that children's brains find it hard to make sense of stories. So they don't immediately get all of the meaning the first time that they listen to it. And then listening to the same thing again and again can help them to practice making sense of stories. And then the more practice they get at making sense of one story, the easier they'll find it to understand the next story. So that's why this is really something that we want to encourage and raise awareness of, because our research suggests that it's not something that many parents would do, but it's definitely something, if you can get your kids listening to long stories, audio stories, and storytelling, it's a great way to make car journeys pass in a flash.
And of course, allowing for time, I mentioned at the start of the piece, sleep can actually help. Not obviously if you're driving, but if you happen to be a passenger, or indeed you're a little child, if you get the timing right as a parent or guardian, that presumably can also make the thing almost pass like magic.
Yes, definitely. Those blissful, instead of a long car journey with wah, or that's my toy, mine, which is what is often the backing music to our car journey. When you have that blissful snore, two snoring children in the backseat. So a lot of the time with that, Alex, it's stuff that honestly we sometimes struggle with my family, which is, you know, planning when to do. So you have to be organized, but if you can do it, it really works. So, you know, you pack up the car, you get ready to leave, and then you do your bedtime routine at home. So you do the things that they're used to doing just before they go to bed, your supper time, your bath time, you're getting into your pajamas, you're reading a story. But then instead of popping them into bed, you pop them right into the car, and that's when you set off. And that generally works really, really well because their bodies are expecting to go to sleep. So all of the preparatory stuff, you know, starts to trigger those going to sleep chemicals before, you know, and then they drop off much more easily. Otherwise, if you just pop them into a car at bedtime without any of the preparation, then if you're anything like my family, you can be driving along at 9:30 in the evening saying to the car, you're supposed to be asleep, like that, and it never quite works. But if you plan it and get it right, then it really, really does help. And you know, if they're dozing happily when you're sleeping, life becomes so much more easy.
Clearly thinking strategically is at the heart of this whole process, and you've raised some of those points exceptionally well, as we knew you would. Where can people go to, Sam, for further information and details, and indeed some of those top tips on how you could avoid toddler tantrums?
So there's audio stories and sing-along songs and nice calming TV that will put your kids in a good mood while they're listening on the Bing app. And there's more advice from me on the website, so bingbunny.com.
Dr. Sam was a child psychologist extraordinaire, always a delight, and keep on keeping on.
Great. Pleasure talking to you, Alex. Thanks for having me.